hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, February 22nd? Where are we? 2012. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today is Jerry Westerson. Noir and hard-boiled fiction is Jerry Westerson's blood. She was born and bred on the mean streets of Los Angeles, inhaling smog and enduring earthquakes. Newspaper reporter, would-be actress, graphic artist, these are the things she spent her time on before becoming a novelist. She took all that gritty edginess and dropped it into the Middle Ages, creating her own style of medieval mystery that she calls medieval noir. Her books have been shortlisted for a slew of mystery awards, including the Macavity, the Agatha, Romantic Times Reviewer's Choice Award, and the Seamus, the first medieval mystery to be nominated for the prestigious PI Award. Library Journal has twice honored her series with starred reviews, and they said, Westerson skillfully lulls her sleuth and the reader into a sense of, I know what is going on, then zings them with the truth. Absolutely first class, highly recommended, while Boston Globe calls her detective a medieval Sam Spade, a tough guy who operates according to his own moral compass. This is going to be great. She also serves as, has also served two terms as president of Sisters in Crime in Orange County and is now VP for the Los Angeles chapter of Sisters in Crime. And if you don't know about Sisters in Crime, you should Google them because it's a wonderful group of mystery readers and writers around the country, perhaps the world. We'll have to ask her. She's also a member of Private Eye Writers of America and the Historical Novel Society. Let's bring her on. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you.
Thanks.
Gosh, I've known of your work for so long. It's about time you're on the show.
Yeah.
Let's begin with you talking about your work and medieval noir.
Yes. This is my own little corner of subgenre of medieval mysteries. And it sort of came about because I was immersed in the Middle Ages, loved the time period, loved to write about it. And when it came time for me to sort of cobble together a medieval mystery series, I didn't want the typical medieval monk or nun as the protagonist. I was enthralled by writing the medieval mystery by the Brother Catfell series, of course, and by Alice Peters, and everybody loves that. She is the mother of all medieval mysteries. This is a monk as a protagonist. But I wanted something a little different. So when I was thinking about the series, I also was reading a lot of the Raymond Chandler hard-boiled detective novels and a lot of the other authors from that period. And I began to think, well, why couldn't I have a hard-boiled kind of private detective and put him in a medieval setting? How would that work? Would that work? And the more I thought about it and sort of worked on it, it did seem to work, this sort of the tropes, taking the tropes of that mm-hmm. period of that hard-boiled detective who's a kind of a lone wolf. He's hard drinking, hard talking, doesn't worry about using his fists to get what he needs. He's a sucker for a dame in trouble. And so those kinds of things translated very well to this time period. And so the character, the detective, he does act as a private detective. He's not just happens to be the monk or nun present, and then there's a body, and then the abbot says, could you investigate this? No, people come to him and hire him to find things, and then he stumbles across murder. So he's called a tracker, because the whole notion of a private detective, of course, didn't exist in 14th century London. So he's a tracker, and he is that sort of kind of lone wolf character, and delving into the whole milieu of the hard-boiled, I discovered that there's a few things that have to belong to the character himself, the detective, and one of them is that he comes with a little bit of angst, comes with a chip on his shoulder. So how could I make this? How could I make this character work in all of that? I wanted him to be a knight because I wanted him to have a facility with languages. I wanted him to have skills with weapons. I wanted him to recognize dead bodies and how long they've been dead and a bunch of other skills where he would be able to move through different levels of society. But he had, you know, why would he be a detective? So he had, of course, to lose everything. He had to reinvent himself. He would lose everything, his knighthood, his lands, his wealth, and he'd have to, everything that defined him, he'd have to reinvent himself as the tracker. So that I had to really knock him around, and I continue to do that. He gets beaten up sometimes.
So, I mean, but what led you here? I mean, were you fascinated with this era, with this century? Were you into historical fiction? I mean, what could you sort of lay out sort of the pieces of the stepping stones for you as a writer that led you to create Crispin Guest, your protagonist, your tracker, and into this series?
Sure. Well, it starts when I was a kid at home. I was raised by rabid Anglophiles. My parents were just very much into medieval history, and particularly English history. And we had books on the shelves. We had all kinds of historical fiction on the shelves from every era. We had historical texts of history on the shelves, and I would just pull them down and look at them and start reading them. And, you know, when I was old enough to read them, but when I wasn't old enough to read them, I would take them down and look at all the pictures of illuminated manuscripts and the weapons and all the fun stuff that you see from that time period, the clothing. And, it was inevitable. You're sitting around the kitchen table, the dinner table, and we're all talking about the British monarchy. So, you know, you have to catch up. You have to keep up with everything and read this stuff. So it's sort of by osmosis. I came by it naturally. I don't have a degree in history, and it was just something I was interested in, an interested amateur, I suppose you could call it, and translated into writing eventually when I became a novelist.
That's interesting. I find it really fascinating how our parents influence us without perhaps even meaning to, you know?
Well, yes, and the encouraging reading. I mean, if you're bored, grab a book. Mm-hmm. And there was always a book to grab. Or do you have a question about a word or something? Go look it up. Mm-hmm. And, we tried to do that with our son, too. Go look it up. And now it's different. You don't have to grab a book off the shelf necessarily, but, research, that's a whole other thing.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm here this morning with Jeri Westerson, and she's the author of the Crispin Guest Medieval Noir series. So, I think most of our listeners are familiar with noir in that it can be reduced down to three elements, the sex, greed, and murder. So then what is medieval noir?
Well, yes, sex, greed, and murder. I like that. and there's another definition that I'll paraphrase. It's everything starts out screwed up and goes downhill from there.
Yeah.
this is... I thought the medieval period would be perfect for this, and not just because we think of it as a darker period, physically, and everything is by candlelight and firelight. But we recognize, though it is a sort of a foreign period to us, because we're talking at this point 600 years ago, they're still recognizable aspects of it, and that's how we can relate. There are still people who were envious and who were greedy and who wanted things their own way and would go to extreme ends to get them, murder being one of them. And there's maybe a jealousy, there's a woman involved perhaps, and so these things transcend time. You can go back to the Bible. You can go back even further than that and find stories of people who want something and who will take it. So I thought it translated rather well. I will say, however, that it's more hard-boiled than it is noir, because recognizing that my readership would be culled from those people who enjoy medieval mysteries more than those people who would read a noir sort of novel, it's sort of noir light. Mm-hmm. So it's more hard-boiled than it is noir. Although, you know, it's not all sunshine and happy endings every time either. By the end of the book, sometimes things are good for Crispin, sometimes not so good. So that's sort of my take on the noir for this sort of time period.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And talk about Crispin, because he's very much a presence. It's as if he's a real person. He lived so very long ago, but you know, you've created quite an authentic character. Talk about how he came about.
Well, it really is. It does come down to character. I mean, why would you spend so much time in book after book if you weren't interested in the character? So it took me a couple of years, really, to develop him and what I was going to do with the series. So Crispin is sort of dark and brooding sort of character. He's sort of a medieval Mr. Darcy for the ladies out there. And a lot of his character sort of developed from reading Sam Spade in Maltese Falcon and the other short stories, Philip Marlowe, Raymond Chandler's detective. And he's even got a little Errol Flynn thrown in there, because I was raised on old movies, mm-hmm. old swashbuckling movies like that. So there's a lot of Errol Flynn moments in some of these books. He's a very smart man. He was very well educated. He likes to quote Aristotle. He likes that philosophy. He had friends with dukes and Geoffrey Chaucer, and as well as thieves. Now that he lives sort of in the underworld of the lower classes, amongst the lower classes there in London, he gets mixed up with relics, with religious relics. Each book seems to deal with a different sort of religious relic, something everybody wants to get their hands on or can't wait to get rid of. And as I said before, he is a sucker for a dame in trouble, because he is, at heart, a knight. He can't seem to get rid of his chivalric code. And it's sort of fun, because Raymond Chandler's Philip Marlowe is styled a white knight. He has his own code that he goes by. And here is Crispin, who really was a knight. So he can't, in his heart, he is still a knight, a nobleman, and he still has a hard struggle with trying to live amongst people that would have been pretty much beneath his notice before. So he struggles with his identity, as many people do. All of those things sort of make him an interesting character, but he doesn't get stuck there, because when you write a series, you're writing the world's biggest novel, and so you have the opportunity to really explore their backstory and their growth with each novel. Each thing that touches them helps to season them and mature them into eventually the people they will become. So it's fun to sort of start Crispin as the lowest of the low, but you know, how does he deal with his life on the Shambles, which is the butcher's district in London? How does he grow with the relationships that he has with the people there? He's got a servant apprentice, Jack Tucker, when we see him in the first book, Vale of Lies, he's an 11-year-old street urchin cut purse who insinuates himself into Crispin's life. Crispin reluctantly takes him in, but he becomes more and more important to Crispin as the books go along. So it's an interesting exploration of a medieval man, a man who was strictly medieval, who lived in that time period and has those sensibilities, but very intelligent and educated in what he does with his time and with that knowledge. How does he change? How does he grow? And solve a bunch of murders.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. This might be a great time to hear you read from your book. Would you do that?
Sure. Sure. This is the latest one, Troubled Bones. And most of the books are set in London, but this one we get to take a field trip to Canterbury. This one is one I've been wanting to write for a while, actually. Geoffrey Chaucer kind of shows up in this one. Crispin is sent to Canterbury to protect the bones of the Saint Thomas Becket, who has a reliquary there, a shrine, and they're threatened by Lollards, which are a sort of reformist movement. And so he's asked by the Archbishop of Canterbury to guard them. And when he arrives, he meets up with a bunch of pilgrims there who have come to Canterbury. And you'll recognize some of them as we go along as characters from the Canterbury Tales. But in this particular scene, one of the pilgrims has just been murdered. It's late at night in the cathedral itself. It's dark. One of the pilgrims has just been found murdered, and Crispin goes to her, but he hears a sound in the cathedral and figures that the murderer is still there. So we're going to start with that.
Okay.
Creeping toward the chapel's wall, Crispin threw himself against the stone and slid carefully along the wall until he reached the archway. He peered around the corner and strained to see through the gray darkness. The night lay heavily over the long nave. Arches gaped into dusky aisles, dimly lit by cloudy moonlight. The thicket of pillars stood like oaks marching away to a murky horizon, while the mute choir stalls stood guard in the center of the nave. Their intricate spires seemed like shadowy figures standing tall above the floor. Crispin crept into the north aisle and stopped to search the gloom. The church was menacing in the dark, with its many shadows and hiding places. Slowly he eased forward and winced when his boots crunched on the tile floor. The smell of old incense hovered thickly in the air, but it couldn't completely mask the coppery stench of blood. He glanced over his shoulder into darkness. There! He turned his head, straining to see, to listen. A shadow swept past his peripheral vision, and he crouched and raised the dagger. His sweaty grip tightened on the handle, and he trotted forward until he reached the south aisle. Slamming into a crevice between a cluster of pillars, he waited, listening, his own musky sweat rising to his nostrils. A step, then a sharp noise, sounded somewhere in the gated choir. Crispin hesitated. The sound wasn't right. Not a step. More like the sound of a tossed pebble trying to send him in the wrong direction. His fingers adjusted their grip on the dagger. Where would the killer try to go? The west door was barred, as were the transepts. The cloister door was open, but that was near St. Bennet's Chapel, the scene of the nun's awful slaying. If the killer wished to escape after the murder, he had already been at the nearest exit. Why then did he need to skulk in the church? What else did he want? Crispin whipped his head eastward toward Becket's shrine, but he couldn't see it for the surrounding scaffolding, a mazework of shade and silky shadows cross-hatching the walls and floors. A loud bang startled him, and then the sound of a door closing. He raced up the south aisle toward the chapel of St. Thomas, dodging webs of scaffolding, before he stumbled going up the chapel stairs. Breathless, he stopped before Prince Edward's tomb, his shoulders rising in silent gasps. The figure of the prince lay undisturbed and staring up at the dark arch ceiling. His brassy skin gleamed dully in the aura of candlelight. In contrast, Becket's shrine, planted in the middle of the chapel, gleamed from four bold candles, burning brightly at each corner of the rectangular sepulchre. All at once, one of the candles, hidden by a corner of the shrine, snuffed out. A black thread of smoke wound upward toward the canopy. Crispin crouched low and tiptoed to the shrine's plinth. He shouldered the wooden base and eased along it toward the edge of the shrine. He felt it at the back of his neck. Whirling, he thrust his dagger, but in mid-turn something heavy struck his wrist, and the knife hit the floor, skidding a few paces. A hooded figure swung a fist upward and caught Crispin's jaw, and then the ground came up to meet him. one of many times he gets hit.
Thank you so much. That was Jerry Westerson reading from Troubled Bones, published by Minotaur Books, in hardcover. And is it in paperback, or is it coming out in paperback?
It will be in trade paper in this fall.
Okay, excellent. You know, it's interesting. You have an art background. You've done a lot of things, but one of them is art. You were in college for design, apparently, and art. And so I am curious of a couple of things: how that may have translated in any way to writing, but also if you created any of the graphics on your website.
I did start in design and art. I started in theater. I was going to be an actress, and then I went to some real world auditions and discovered, ooh, I don't want to do this the rest of my life. This is awful. What else can I do? All I know are the arts, you know, acting and mm-hmm. and designing and writing. And so this one better work out. This is my third career. So art was great. I enjoyed it. And it did influence me, because when I was a kid, I was fascinated by illuminated manuscripts. And for those who don't know what those are, if you think of parchments, if you think of medieval books, they're all handwritten. They're done by hand, wonderful calligraphy. And some pages are illuminated. They're all these wonderful drawings on them and designs, and they sort of take one of the initial letters of a sentence, and they make it large, and they put figures in it, and so on. All of these, and there's gold leaf actually in it, and wonderful paintings, and it's a lot of what we know of what people look like and what they wore in the Middle Ages, because they didn't really do paintings as such in this time period. So illuminated manuscripts fascinated me, and I taught myself calligraphy. I learned how to use pens, and I learned how to prepare inks, and I even designed some different typefaces. And later, I discovered that people made a living doing something like that. And when I decided to switch majors in college, I switched to art and design, and learned that after all of those years when I was designing programs and posters for all the theater things I was involved in, that was a career. So the illuminated manuscripts sort of brought me to design, and then full circle back to illuminated manuscripts in the Middle Ages. And I did design the look of my website, mm-hmm. pretty much. Mm-hmm. I try not to do too much of that on my own anymore. Mm-hmm. But I was doing this before computers were really involved in graphics. I was a hands-on kind of gal. I really did all of that by hand in those days. I was fast, and I was good. I enjoyed it very much. But by the time I had I sort of semi-retired to have a child, and when he was about two, as a toddler, and I was going to get back into graphic design because I wanted to do something at home, as I had been doing, the whole industry had turned to computers. Mm-hmm. And I, alas, had not. But I do write on a computer. I did learn computers, but I would never do that by hand or on a typewriter.
Sure, sure. Well, we have so much more to talk about, so we are going to take a real quick break, and I hope you all stay with us for more Jerry Westerson. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, Rome wasn't built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Listen to Writers on Writing
every Wednesday morning
at 9 a.m.
with Miss Barbara
and Miss Murray.
Did we say it was Wednesday?
Wednesday!
At 9?
Wednesday!
In the morning?
Wednesday!
The opinions and views expressed on this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about the show or other programs on KUCI, please log on to KUCI.org for the latest program schedule.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at KUCI.org and iTunes College Radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I've been here with Jerry Westerson. And before we bring her back on, just a few things. One is that this show and many shows are podcast at writersonwriting.blogspot.com. You can get there by going to my website, which is penonfire.com. We have been having some technical difficulties with our podcast, but we're slowly getting them all back up, and right now there's quite a slew of them to listen to. So this one will join the rest in the next week or two if you want to tune back in or send your writing friends or reading friends to it. The Pen on Fire speaker series will host Dennis Palumbo on March 6th. That's also on the penonfire.com website. Click on Writer Salon. Jerry's website is jerrywesterson.com. There's a lot of great stuff there about her books, about where she's going to be speaking and doing events, and lots of fun stuff. And I want to, before I forget, talk to her about some of her fun stuff. Let's bring her back on. Hi, Jerry.
Hi there.
Great to have you with us. You know, I've been looking at your website, and I like your fun stuff tab, where you have, for one thing, you have maps. You have a map of London, I think, in what, the 13th century?
Yeah, there's one in the, it's 14th century, I believe. I have one there, and then there's another one that's, it's 1300s, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can see how small London is.
Mm-hmm. Really?
It really is within the walls, the original walls. By about Crispin's time, of course, it was spreading out. And if you look at the Thames, there's a big bend in the river. And way down at the bottom, that's where Westminster is.
Mm-hmm.
We think of it as all one city. And, of course, it kind of is now considered one city. But Westminster, where the palace, the King's Palace was Westminster Abbey, and, where Big Ben is now. That was all in another city, say Westminster, and London was up the Thames a bit. So it was a walk to get from London proper to Westminster.
Mm-hmm.
About 30 minutes of walking, but London did spread eventually. It spread out slowly. What it mostly did was go up, go upward. They started building second and third stories to some of the housing there. And so it sort of became very canyon-like. A lot of these streets are very narrow and very shadowy. So that sort of, particularly I thought, lent itself to sort of hard-boiled kind of a mystery.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I love that. And also, of course, your cats. You know, we have a Maine coon as well, and how you describe him being the size of a frozen turkey.
Yes. He is indeed. My Maine coon, his name is Murray, and he's a very sweet guy, but he's a big guy.
Yeah.
Never had a Maine coon before, and when we got him from a shelter, and when I looked it up on the internet to see what a Maine coon was like, and I was shocked to see all the things they described that the cat will do, this sort of breed will do, and he does it. It's very strange. You know, follow you around like a dog, wait outside of doors for you, and just a big, lovey kind of frozen turkey kind of a cat.
Well, you know, ours is huge, too, and we've had him on a diet thinking that maybe he's too big, but he's not taking well to this, and I'm thinking maybe it's
bigger.
The breed.
He's just started bigger.
For 2 weeks now, he's still not used to it. It's like,
well,
come on.
What would writers be without their cats? You got to have a cat.
Oy.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, let's get back. Let's get back to writing and the book, because I think we could go off on cats for quite a bit. So back to something you said a while ago, and that is that it comes down to character, and it took you a couple of years to develop Crispin.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious whether you're talking about developing him as you were writing him, or did you wait until you had a pretty solid fix on who the character was that was then going to populate a series? And then the second part of that question is, how did you know it was going to be a series when you began, and did you plan for that?
Well, I actually didn't write anything about him for 2 years. I was writing other things, and there was a lot of thinking and a lot of sort of lots of research, and really just sort of experimenting with who he was going to be. Every time I sort of mentioned this to people that, hey, I'm going to write this medieval mystery and I'm going to cross-pollinate this hard-boiled thing with medieval, and he's going to be a detective and a private eye kind of guy, you know. And I was very excited about it. And every time I mentioned it to somebody, they didn't seem very enthused about it. And I thought, no, this is a great idea. I know this is a great idea, and I'm going to develop it. So it really did take that long, just really ruminating on it and developing his character. And, you know, what sort of world he was going to be involved in. I wanted to make sure that the research was down so I knew where I was going to put him. And it was always planned as a series. Before that, I was writing historical fiction. These were all standalones, and none of them were getting published. So I switched. I was encouraged by a former agent to write a mystery because it was a better market, supposedly better market. Because it, truly, at the time that I was writing historical fiction, and this is around the 90s, Publishers Weekly had declared it dead. So that's great. That's what I'm writing. I'll write that, the dead things. So I switched to mystery. It's a bigger market. There are independent bookstores that only carry mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
There's
sure.
tons of conventions and conferences that feature mysteries. And
yeah, there's such a solid community of mystery writers.
It is. And so I thought, well, I don't know how to write a mystery, but I will learn. I know how to research, so I will research this, and I will write. And so that's sort of how that all developed. And yes, I always knew it was going to be a series. And in fact, because there's such a rich historical background of this, every time period there is, but this particular part that I chose of the Middle Ages, because we're talking about a period that spans about 1,000 years, but I wanted to choose this period. You follow the history, you know, you use history as your basis, and then you hang your fiction on it, sort of like a clothes on a clothesline. So there is a real timeline that follows, and then Crispin's life sort of will follow that. So I sort of have a very definite time period that I wanted to follow, and then I developed Crispin's life to go along with it.
Yeah. So, you know, along the lines then of writing a series, and you said you were writing standalone historical novels that weren't selling, do you find that having a series is at least a part of the appeal because readers want a series, and so agents and editors are more likely to take a mystery by, say, well, newer or not new author? But, you know, take a mystery more seriously.
I wasn't published, so for what it was worth, I was a newbie author.
So then do you think the series aspect was, you know, made it all doubly appealing?
Yeah, I think it does, at least in mystery category. They don't want the one-trick pony. They want to make sure that there will be, because, historical is a subgenre of mystery, and as you get down in the sub-genres of historical, medieval, and now medieval noir, you're narrowing your focus, and so it takes time to build that audience. And to build that audience, you need a series. You need people to come across the series and discover it and then learn to love the characters. As a side note to really developing a character that's worthwhile, that people will want to follow for book after book, you're talking about how, he seems like a real character, and he seems like a real character to me. There's so much in his backstory, some things that will come out and some things that never will, but that I know about him. I was doing some extra research on John of Gaunt, the Duke of Lancaster, that was the household in which Crispin grew up. John of Gaunt was his mentor. He's the respected sort of father figure. So I'm reading about John of Gaunt, and in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, well, I'm going to come across Crispin any minute now as I'm going through these pages. And then I had to stop myself saying, no, you won't, Jerry. He doesn't really exist. He exists only in your mind. So that was a really interesting moment. But I convinced myself so much that he really did exist that I expected to find him in the textbook. But that's the sort of thing that you want readers to feel, too. You want them to think that this is a real person, that this could have happened, and that they might come across him in some historical piece.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it is interesting how these characters come alive, and even in writing them, how you start thinking that it is someone, even though it is, they lived too long ago to be here now, unless in another body, perhaps. But
and that's the wonderful thing about the series aspect, is that, you do have the chance to really tell their story. Mm-hmm. And I believe that there should be a finite number in a series. I don't think it should go on and on. Because there is always the problem that you can become too formulaic, and I try not to be.
So did you propose it as a number? I have three, three in this series, and this one's about this, and this one's about this. And
well, I have, if all goes well, there are 18 in this series.
Is that how you proposed it?
But you just proposed it as a series, in this case, they just bought the first one, and I had already written the first three, and I was working on the fourth one. They just were submitting the first, and then by the time they bought that one and it was selling, then they offered the two books, contracts along the way. But the first one that I turned in, which is the one coming out this October, the fifth book in the series, Bloodlance, that was the first one I wrote under a deadline, which was a different experience too. But I was so used to being writing these novels and then not getting published, I'd just jump into the next novel and start writing the next one. But particularly with the series, I was concerned because I'd never written a series before. My mind was set on writing standalones. When you got to the end, that was the end of that story, and you'd start writing a different one. So I had to see if I could actually do that to get my mind set on continuing the story. Could I write more about this character? Do I like him enough to keep writing about him? And the answer was yes, I do.
Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm here this morning with Jerry Westerson, and we're talking about her medieval noir series and her character Crispin Guest. And what a great name, too.
Yes.
How did you come up with his name?
Crispin is a saint's name, and that's, you know, you do have to pick names that are apt for the time period. You can't very well start naming people Heather, and, you know, it's just not right for the period. So a lot of people were named after saints or after the king, you know. Crispin is a good saint's name. You remember from Henry V, the St. Crispin's Day speech. So I was looking for a last name, and I was working on a whole list of different names that I wanted for him. Nothing was working. And I came across the name Guest as a last name, and I thought, oh, it seems vaguely French. That's kind of a good name. Well, as I explored it, it's really not French. It's actually Welsh, which actually works better for his character when I was developing that. And I thought, oh, this is also a great Dickensian sort of descriptive name, because his name is Guest, but he's not welcomed anywhere.
So that's
sort of that kind of thing.
Yeah, it does something on another level.
And I do like to do that with names. Mm-hmm. I choose very carefully the names, and I do look at old documents and try to find last names and first names that are right for the period, and sometimes I go to other sources. There's a lot of documentation. England was very big on documenting, and they documented a lot of trials and court documents from the period. And so a lot of people who didn't really have last names were given sort of nicknames, and a lot of the names that I give to some of the bad guys or other people are sort of based on some of these little nicknames. So these are in jokes for historians who are the only ones who would get it. Everybody's got to get something.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that makes it interesting, you know, when you're doing things on different levels and this is going to reach this reader and this is going to reach that reader. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it keeps it interesting.
Oh, I think so. Yeah, you have to. You have to do that for yourself.
Yeah.
As well as the you know, other readers. And, you know, there is a noir in-joke in the second book, Serpent and the Thorns, with the name of one of the characters. And you'll have to email me if you want to know what that
is. I do want to know.
Well, you have to email me.
Okay. Well, you know, talk also about, because you write under a pseudonym, too.
I do.
Do you want to talk about that? Because I find it so interesting when, you know, it's like you have different readers and a certain group of readers is going to read this stuff, but they're probably not going to read that stuff. And this other group of readers is going to read that stuff, but they're not going to read this stuff. And it's so interesting the number of writers who write under pseudonyms and have for decades,
and
centuries.
Like there is a lot of crossover, actually. I write a contemporary gay mystery series. So I have a protagonist who is a gay English teacher in present day California. And it's a mystery series, and it's completely different from the Crispin series. It's lighter, funny, and sexy, and it's just it's a huge departure for me, and I did that deliberately so that I would have something that would just be in between the Crispin books, sort of something a little lighter.
So how do you do that then in terms of, do you have the same agent, publisher, do you keep your identities totally
different?
Separate?
I mean, sometimes people have the same things, but this is again another, I love to pick those niche markets, don't I? Never get rich that way, Jerry. It would be a completely different thing.
But I mean, do they all know about all the different things you're doing? And they're like, yeah, this has to be separate because you're doing this and you're doing that.
Well, you know, and that is why you do have authors do have different pen names.
Mm-hmm.
It's not to protect their interests or anything. It's because, you know, if you pick up a Jerry Westerson book, you're going to get a medieval mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and if you're picking up a Hayley Walsh book, you know, you're going to get a gay mystery. And if you're going to, you know, a different, that's branding is what it is,
right.
You know, and so you just know what you're going to get. And it's strictly a marketing thing.
So how do you do promotion then for the the books under a pseudonym. How does that work? It reminds me of a book that, a novel that Scott Spencer wrote years ago called, I think it was called Men in Black, which has no relation to current movies. But, and it was about a ghostwriter, or actually it was about a writer writing under a pseudonym who then became this best-selling writer. And, you know, part of it was the problem with promoting, you know, that, because he wasn't supposed to be who he was, or he wasn't supposed to look the way he looked, and, you know, all these different things. And I find that so interesting.
Mm. It's not easy because, well, the whole LGBT publishing industry is a whole different ball game, really. There's so fewer bookstores now, GLBT bookstores. You're not going to really make any bookstore appearances. You're not going to be on a whole bunch of panels on things. When I do events, it's all for Crispin Books.
Mm-hmm.
For one, because those are the series that makes me a living.
Mm-hmm.
For another, there's just not a big call for it. But so it's a lot of online promotion.
Uh-huh.
It's a whole different schematic of what you have to do, and it's I still don't know if I have a handle on it, but it's a lot of chat things and getting reviewed on blogs, and it's a whole different thing.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I really like
and authors
that.
Do have to spend a too much time on promotion.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because you're the queen of it. I mean, your website is just beautiful, and you continue to do events, and you're all over the place. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, if you get into this for the money, that you're in the wrong business, for one, unless you hit the jackpot and you become a best-selling author right away. And then many of these tasks will be taken over for you. But you pretty much are your own publicist, and you must maintain, you know, your own presence on the web. You've got to be there on the web. I have my website, of course, which is fairly static except for my schedule. My schedule is full. I like to be at places and talk. And I usually bring my medieval weaponry with me, by the way. So,
oh, yeah? Okay.
Go look on my schedule and where I'm going to be, and maybe I'll be near you, and I will be swinging my sword around. So you have to do that. And then social networking, of course. I blog. I have my own blog, Getting Medieval. And Crispin has his own blog.
Yes, he does.
Go to Crispin's blog and see what's up with him. Twitter and Facebook and things like that, where you just try to get more people interested in you and your books. Goodreads, library thing, all these other social networking things online. But there's nothing like, you know, there's that. It gets more, gets your name out to more people, but there is nothing like those personal appearances. Last year, I pulled out all the stops, and I went all over the place on my tour, all year. But also, when the book came out, sort of made a big push, a multi-state tour. And there is really nothing like meeting the people right then and there. And a lot of people showed up because of Facebook. So, in between all that, you have to write the next book. So
how do you discipline yourself to stay offline when you're writing? I mean,
well,
it's so
hard.
Easy.
It's hard. You kind of get addicted to, well, what's going on Facebook? You know, what's on the email? But I try to get at least some of the emailing and blogging done in the morning, first thing in the morning, because there's a lot of New York, not a lot of East Coast stuff that happens, so I have to get that done in the morning. And then try to not do so much Facebook during the day. It does get addicting, but you do have to discipline yourself. I try to give myself a minimum of writing 10 pages a day, and that's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of work.
That's
It doesn't sound like much to people who don't write, but really, it's a lot.
No, but people who do write, that's gobs. That's maybe 2,500, 3,000 words.
Yeah. But I started as a as a journalist, too. I mean, one of the things that I did, one of the many little jobs that I had while I was trying to get published, was I was a newspaper reporter for about 8 years. And I really think that learning to write for newspapers, which fast deadlines, and you have to, in writing features, I wasn't writing news stories, but writing features, which are like mini short stories, and you learn to produce something that has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think it really helps you cut down on all the excess that you would might have put into your novels as well.
Yeah, yeah, I do too. I hear that from just about every journalist I know who's turned to fiction or long form narrative nonfiction. It's that deadline and having to keep yourself in the chair.
Right. Yeah.
We are at the end of our time. I wonder if you have any last words for the writers who are listening.
Well, it's just perseverance, really. I mean, I'm the poster child for perseverance, I think. It took me 14 years to get published, so I was writing things that the historical novels at the wrong time and switched when somebody advised it, and taking the advice of people with some knowledge, getting yourself into some writing organizations if you can. I'm a huge advocate mm-hmm. for Sisters in Crime, and if you write mysteries, and read a lot. Please read a wide variety of things, not just the genre that you write, but everything will help. All the words that you find on the page are going to help your vocabulary and your outlook and give you ideas that will take you places.
Yeah, sure will. And you're going to be a bunch of places in coming months. So everybody out there, check out Jerry's website at jerrywesterson.com. And thank you so much for being with us for the entire hour, Jerry.
Well, thank you, Barbara.
You're welcome. It was Jerry Westerson. Her website, again, is jerrywesterson.com. And if you want to know more about the show or you want to know more about the Pen on Fire Writer Salon, do visit penonfire.com and click on the different links there. And pretty soon I'm going to have to get my cats up there, too. it's sad but true. Anyway, I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I'm going to leave you now. And going to leave you with Etta James, who left the planet a couple of months ago, not quite, and one of my all-time favorite blues singers. So have a great day. Don't forget to write. Don't forget to read. And we'll talk soon.